for cultivating progress across the South, for working to unconditionally improve the lives of all, and for the bold underwriting of every Gravy podcast. SFA thanks our visionary Louisville, Kentucky friends, Pam and Brooke Smith.
In great restaurants, the menu and the wine list certainly matter, but it's the swirl and energy of the dining room that make the place sizzle, that makes diners want to return again and again. People flirting at the bar, a couple falling in love during a first date conversation at a two-top in the corner, the birthday and anniversary and graduation celebrations at the big table against the wall, the politicians and business types doing whatever it is politicians and business types do. Somehow you know this restaurant in this moment is the place to be. San Antonio's Mi Tierra is that kind of place. And it's even more. Pull up a chair and listen as Evan Stern introduces us to the Cortez family and explores the wonder of Mi Tierra. I'm Melissa Hall. You're listening to Gravy.
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 A production of the Southern Foodways Alliance, Gravy tells the stories of the changing American South.
That voice you're hearing belongs to Beatriz Gonzalez. A singer from South Texas, she went viral in 2017 when her performance of the ranchera classic Los Laureles hit the internet. Shot on a smartphone at her dinner table at San Antonio's Mi Tierra, alongside one of the restaurant's famed roving trios, it's since been viewed more than 4.5 million times on YouTube. Impromptu moments like these aren't uncommon at Mi Tierra, especially on Saturdays. That's when the servers in Mexican-inspired red, white, and green gowns regularly serve trays of enchiladas, fajitas, and flautas to as many as 5,000 diners. The feel on weekday mornings, though, is different. The trios are still there, and the spirit's always convivial, but it's easier to get a table. There are fewer birthday parties and tourists, more bankers, cops on break, civic leaders like former Mayor Henry Cisneros, and if you come on a Friday around 8:30, you'll likely find Ellen Riojas Clark holding court at a long table with a breakfast club of Latina progressives called the Political Divas.
Hello, chula. ¿Cómo estás?
A renowned food historian and professor emerita in the Department of Bicultural Studies at the University of Texas, San Antonio, Dr. Clark tells me the Divas came together nearly 20 years ago to campaign for Julian Castro's first mayoral bid. They've remained active in politics ever since and gather here regularly to meet with leaders to strategize over pan dulce and breakfast tacos. They tell me they inherited this table from an older group of male power brokers who were known as the Snake Pit and belonged to a long line of San Antonians for whom Mi Tierra has provided a place of confluence.
It has a rich political history, social history, and of course an economic history. But it's a place that all of San Antonio goes to. Mi Tierra is part of the fiber of San Antonio.
As a proud Alamo City native, Dr. Clark can make this claim from a place of lived experience.
I was born in 1941, which is the year that Mi Tierra started in Market Square. And my dad remembers when I was born, he had been with my mom when she was having labor, and then he leaves the hospital and goes to Mi Tierra, that was a hole in the wall, to have breakfast.
8 decades later, Mi Tierra is far from a hole in the wall. Encompassing an entire block on the western edge of downtown in the heart of historic Market Square, ownership claims it ranks amongst the busiest restaurants in the United States. More than this, though, Dr. Clark argues Mi Tierra is a living, breathing document of San Antonio history. Its menu features regional favorites like menudo and chalupas compuestas. Their caldo specials, which are stews that blend meat and vegetables like squash, corn, and chayote, have been served since the days the neighborhood teemed with produce stalls. Yet Dr. Clark stresses that Mi Tierra's design tells a story as well.
It's not just the food, it's that the whole surrounding of it.
The main dining hall is filled with framed sepia photos of the restaurant and neighborhood collected in the decades since opening. Its back room also features a massive floor-to-ceiling fresco. Called the American Dream Mural, its Diego Rivera-like scene depicts a cavalcade of over 100 Latino business leaders, politicians, and cultural icons. The entryways house altars that pay tribute to departed staff and regulars, and its ceilings are obscured by multicolored piñatas and papel picado. Coupled with the sounds of mariachi music, the result is almost overwhelming on the senses. But Dr. Clark insists this effect is both intentional and important.
People don't understand why Mi Tierra is so flamboyant, as they put it. It forces you to look up, to look and enjoy the objects and the elements of who we are.
The we she's speaking of are Mexican Americans. And without their presence, San Antonio would not exist. Well before the Spaniards established the city as a mission in 1718, the land here provided a home to tribes like the Payaya, who hunted along the region's creek beds and lived off its artesian wells. For this, many residents claim indigenous roots that span centuries. Yet the story Mi Tierra represents is one of immigrants who brought their culture with them to a new start on Texas soil. Third-generation owner Pete Cortez tells me their family history in San Antonio began with his grandfather, Pedro, who, like many newcomers to the U.S., saw his name changed upon arrival.
His name was changed to Z. It was actually Cortez with an S, which actually has another whole meaning in terms of like Cortez, like courtesy, hospitality, which it was really interesting because, you know, I don't think in his wildest dreams he probably thought as a kid that he was going to end up, you know, starting a restaurant company.
Born in Guadalajara in 1918, following the death of his mother, a young Pedro Cortez moved to San Antonio, where his aunt and uncle owned a grocery store. Upon quitting the ninth grade, he worked for them as a butcher and eventually began delivering meat to customers around town. It was on these rounds he met his wife Cruz and also became friendly with many restaurant proprietors. One owned a small dinette called Jamaica No. 5 and was so taken with Cortez's affability and work ethic, he sold him his business rights.
He borrowed money from the aunt who owned the grocery store. It was $150 and was able to buy the restaurant, three tables.
From the start, Cortez's menu and business practices were impacted by his surroundings. The restaurant was situated on Produce Row in the heart of Market Square. Built in the late 1800s as an open-air arcade, the square was established to relocate vendors from downtown's main Plaza de Armas following the construction of a new city hall. By the time of Cortez's arrival, it had grown into a bustling three-block district, bounded by Dolorosa and Commerce Streets, with sprawling buildings that allowed farmers to drive inside to sell off their trucks. A crucial artery in the region's food supply chain, Dr. Clark paints a picture of what Market Square was like at its zenith between the wars.
Market Square was a vibrant place of commerce. Vegetables were sold, flowers were sold, medicinal things were sold.
In the days before supermarkets, its many peddlers supplied goods for both citizens and businesses from stalls, pushcarts, and flatbed trailers. Some came directly from area farms, others from wholesalers around the nation. While visitors in the early 40s marveled at fruits like mango, papaya, and avocado imported from Mexico. More than this, Market Square evolved into a juncture for socialization with street musicians and entertainers that reminded Cortez of his hometown Guadalajara. It was also here that Texas Mexican food was largely introduced to the masses.
Texas Mexican cuisine is nothing new. It is a food that has its ancient roots and that has evolved over time using ingredients that are from this region.
That's Christine Ortega. A San Antonio native who serves as VP of the Texas Indigenous Food Project, she emphasizes that Texas Mexican is a new name assigned to a cuisine with ancient roots. Its staples include carne guisada, which are stewed beef tips and gravy, and that beloved blend of peppers, meat, and seasonings known as chile con carne. Crucial in popularizing these dishes were enterprising young women known as chili queens, who first set up open-air kitchens in the main plaza before shifting operations to Market Square. Served from crude tables covered with oilcloth and lamps, they'd open at nightfall and remove all wares between the vegetable and forage vendors' selling hours. Old photos from the 30s reveal a cross-section of workers, out-of-town visitors, and even the mayor sitting elbow to elbow before heaping bowls of stew.
These women were extremely smart. They were not doing anything really new, but what was happening is that they were organized and that they were featuring dishes that people love to taste and love to eat. So that was the first fast food restaurant of its time.
While Cortez served dishes like chile relleno from his native Mexico, he adopted many of these local favorites as well, which remain on Mi Tierra's menu today. He did this under the banner of Jamaica No. 5 for a decade, and eventually opened his doors 24 hours in order to accommodate the market's round-the-clock activity. Then, as Pete recounts, when his grandfather turned 33, he seized upon an opportunity to give up his month-to-month lease, buy property, and expand his operation beyond three tables in a new building. The new space featured a significantly larger kitchen and dining room with lunch counter and booths with miniature jukeboxes. Cortez rechristened his business Mi Tierra, a name Pete says held deeply personal and symbolic connotations.
It's sort of a very patriotic statement that he was making when he named this restaurant Mi Tierra, because it really means it's like, this is my country, this is my land, this is where I come from.
After the break, we'll learn how the Cortez family helped shape the market square of today.
Gravy has some big news for Dolly Parton fans. Lodge Cast Iron has launched a new collection of Dolly Parton cast iron. Inspired by the one and only Tennessee icon, each of the four cookware pieces brings a bit of Dolly flair to your favorite Southern dishes. Just like Dolly, cast iron is made in Tennessee and loved all over the world. Made with just iron and oil, the naturally seasoned cooking surface on a Lodge pan is made to last for generations, so you'll never have to change your tune. Take home the new Lodge Cast Iron Dolly Parton collection and shop cookware born to perform at LodgeCastIron.com. For Lodge's longtime support of the Southern Foodways Alliance and this podcast, we thank them.
To appreciate Mi Tierra's significance in San Antonio, you have to understand its relationship to Market Square and the role it and people like Pedro Cortez played in sustaining the area when it was threatened with destruction. Today, the square ranks alongside the Alamo as one of San Antonio's most visited sites. Over 2 million flock here each year to shop, enjoy live music on the weekends, or party each spring. That's when nearly 200 bands battle for attention on different stages during the city's 10-day fiesta celebration. But while the square remains one of the largest Mexican markets in the U.S., it bears little resemblance to the center of exchange Pedro Cortez saw when he first moved to San Antonio. Produce hasn't been sold here in nearly 50 years, and you won't find any farmers in the building that's still called the Farmers Market. In their place are over 100 curio shops and artisans selling imports and items like jewelry, leather, ceramics, and textiles. While most agree a pivot was needed to keep the market viable, its loss as a food source remains something of an open wound for people like Christine Ortega, whose uncle's stall was forced out.
How do you get fresh produce downtown? How do you combat the food deserts? Well, in San Antonio, we had already developed our own organic social mixes and our commercial mixes that worked. And the city and other government forces chose to destabilize it for their own kind of economic purposes.
The forces that led to the market's initial decline were multi-layered. Starting in the 30s, health regulations, licenses, and fines forced the Chili Queens to close their outdoor kitchens. In 1951, dozens of stall holders moved their operations to a larger, newly constructed wholesale market. Shopping practices, of course, began shifting towards chain groceries. But Christine argues the construction of Interstate 35 dealt a particularly harsh blow. Built through eminent domain in the name of urban renewal, its multiple lanes of traffic directly parallel the market and isolated it from its Mexican-American customer base on San Antonio's west side.
The market square didn't decline on its own. The city brought about the decline by clearing out neighborhoods and not relocating people nearby and not creating the infrastructure to keep that place vibrant. They destabilized it. It was caused by the factors of urban renewal.
This destabilization resulted in multiple vacancies and the challenges of vagrancy associated with empty storefronts. Yet it also provided Pedro Cortes with an opportunity to expand, and in 1961 he became the neighborhood's largest private landowner when he purchased the entire block surrounding Mi Tierra. Unfortunately, though, as Pete recounts, soon after making this ambitious investment, his grandfather learned the city had other plans for his buildings, as well as the entire market.
You know, Mr. Cortes, you know, you've made a big mistake, you know, investing in all this property, because we're going to tear this down. We're going to tear this whole neighbor down. We're going to buy you out via eminent domain, and, you know, you're going to have to move on.
For Pedro, this news was devastating, both as a business owner and one who loved and continued to believe in the market's promise. As Pete tells it, his grandfather had always maintained an almost single-minded focus on work. Yet with so much at stake, this situation forced him into a position of public advocacy.
He didn't have any political ambition, but that was at the point where he realized that if he was going to save this neighborhood, he had to get involved. He sort of had to cozy up to that, because it was, unless you were Anglo, you were really not welcome.
Pete's words are not without truth or irony. Today, San Antonio's population is nearly two-thirds Latino, and the city's elected leadership is more broadly reflective of this constituency. Yet for generations before 1965's Voting Rights Act, its communities of color were denied a voice through gerrymandering and means of subjugation that Christine still recalls.
I remember my grandmother saying, we have to go downtown, I have to pay for my poll tax. And if she had to pay $3 for her poll tax, that was a lot of money.
The levers of power in the early 60s were also largely controlled by a group of Anglo professionals called the Good Government League, who worked to influence the city council and push business-friendly policies. While unversed in politics, Pedro recognized the advantage in appealing to this body. So he got together with neighboring owners and began requesting meetings with the league's board members. Having spent years in hospitality, Cortes was able to charm and build alliances with league members who helped introduce him and his allies to sympathetic ears.
He was able to make, you know, some really lifelong friendships. And, you know, they helped him and started a whole new aspect of how we now operate, which is community involvement.
Well before repurposing industrial spaces was trendy, they discussed charting a new future for the neighborhood that built on memories of the artisanal districts Cortes remembered from his native Jalisco. Their craftsmen, like potters, carpenters, and painters, drew visitors and well-heeled shoppers. In turn, their foot traffic supported a vibrant street life teeming with bars, restaurants, and mariachis.
His model for him was Tlaquepaque in Guadalajara. I mean, in his mind, he knew immediately what to do. I mean, as soon as the farmers had left and it was time to figure out where we're going to go next, I mean, he was already, look, let me take you to Guadalajara. Let me show you exactly what I'm envisioning that all of this could be.
As San Antonio was at this time heavily promoting and investing in itself as a tourist destination, the vision they were selling, which showcased the city's Latin identity, was one the Chamber of Commerce could advocate for. With their help, the first market committee was formed, an advisory group headed by renowned architect Boone Powell. They developed a plan to lure new vendors, close Produce Row and its side streets to traffic, and redesigned the district as a fountain-lined plaza. In time, demolition plans were scrapped, bond measures approved, and in 1976, this new iteration of Market Square was introduced to the public. Since then, it's emerged as one of San Antonio's treasured gathering spots. And Pete believes that success lies in its embrace of Mexican culture.
People who have left the city, when they come back, they always want to come back here, because it's sort of like how they reconnect immediately. I think of it sort of like an IV. I mean, you know, you come back to Market Square and it's like getting a dose intravenously, I mean, of the culture, and you're just right, you snap right back to where you were.
If sustainable preservation isn't static, but something that evolves to stay meaningful as times change, many like Ellen Riojas Clark applaud Market Square's evolution as an example of this concept in action.
This is 2024. It has changed in character. For the worse, no. For the better, it's still operating as a place to sell goods and to sell culture.
At the same time, others like Christine Ortega have conflicted feelings surrounding San Antonio's reliance on tourism and Market Square's emergence in this ecosystem that's now the city's third largest industry.
Cultural preservation and economic enterprise are two forces that are constantly in a tension.
Ortega at times struggles with the city's framing of Latino culture and has questioned the market's authenticity and who it truly serves.
The survival of Market Square is all about making money. And I think in many ways it has learned how to exaggerate and how to elevate some of those aspects of our food, our music, to capture not just the imagination of visitors, but also their money.
Yet she also loves its colors, recognizes its value as a place of celebration, and is grateful for its existence. And while Pedro Cortez was one of many who worked hard to save Market Square, she and others I spoke with agree it's hard to imagine how its story would have unfolded without him or Mi Tierra.
Thank God for the Cortez family. Had they not had ownership of the space, it would probably look very different than it does today. All right. Their influence was instrumental in terms of preserving a lot of the character of the Market Square. And they truly are a family that has been an anchor to preserve and protect and celebrate our culture and our food. So for that, they should be greatly appreciated.
As an anchor, Mi Tierra and the Cortez family have maintained a presence in San Antonio for over 80 years. And while Pete tells me he remembers getting put to work drying silverware in the kitchen before the first grade, this longevity wasn't in any way planned or thrust upon him.
You know, my dad would always tell me that, oh, I don't want you to be in this, I don't want you to be in the restaurant business. I want you to be a doctor. I want you to be a lawyer. I want you to be an engineer.
Yet, decades later, he still puts on an apron to help in the kitchen and works on Christmas mornings. And while fewer than 12% of family businesses survive the transition from founder to third generation, Pete tells me his children are committed to making it to the fourth. At this point, he says, restaurants run in this family's blood. Yet Mi Tierra's longevity is owed to more than this. It's consistently good food, location, or atmosphere. Among many translations, Tierra means ground. The Cortez family and this restaurant are grounded by the knowledge of both where they're from and where they are today as Mexican Americans. And while San Antonio existed before Mi Tierra, by weathering change and surviving against steep odds, restaurants like these help ground communities and cities around our world. Dr. Clark tells me the grounding Mi Tierra provides is both culinary and social cultural, and that it offers a symbol of Latino endurance. After breakfast with the divas comes to an end, over the sound of the trios, I ask her, what do those words, Mi Tierra, mean to you?
It's mine. It's my land, my food, my culture, and my place in San Antonio. It is my place, my home.
Evan Stern produced and reported this episode of Gravy. He is the host and creator of Vanishing Postcards, named one of the best podcasts of 2022 by Digital Trends. An actor, singer, and sixth-generation Texan, he's performed on the stages of New York's Lincoln Center, Carnegie Hall, and the Oak Room at the Algonquin. We thank Wendell Patrick for Gravy's theme music. We also owe a huge thank you to Clay Jones and Broadcast Studios of Oxford, Mississippi for recording and mixing Gravy. Managing editor for Gravy and all other SFA media is Sarah Camp Milam. Olivia Terenzio is our podcast editor. Fact-checking comes courtesy of Heather Cole. Mary Beth Lassiter is our publisher.
Sarah Camp here with an offer from our sister publication, Gravy Quarterly. We're hard at work on our summer issue, a deep dive into restaurants, guest edited by Hannah Raskin of the Food Section. We're offering you, Gravy podcast listeners, a free copy of that issue to see what Gravy Quarterly is all about. All you have to do is send your name and mailing address to gravyquarterly@southernfoodways.org by June 15th. That's Gravy Quarterly at southernfoodways.org. The summer issue will arrive in your mailbox in mid-July. You're welcome.
I'm Melissa Hall, excited to lap up another episode of Gravy. Tell a friend, pass the gravy boat. There is plenty to go around.